J.R. Shaw and John Jay, united by sport. We are Sportsnet 650. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love.
I'm all shook up. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, guys. Nice to be on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pleasure. And it was also a pleasure reading this article. So many great things that we got to learn about Roberto Alomar. Because first of all, you know, with his career and all the accomplishments that he has to his name, to his credit, nobody would blame Roberto if he wanted to spend his time in a ritzy cafe or like in his penthouse suite doing nothing but eating caviar for the rest of his days. But it's truly telling of the character he is that he's willing to go back home to Puerto Rico. It's obviously a devastated country by the recent floods and attacks, the natural disasters there. It is telling about Roberto Alomar's character that he's willing to make this all happen, and he's the one who generated it all.
Oh, no, definitely. I saw a side of Robbie Alomar during my time in Puerto Rico that I did not expect to see. You know, the image that people in this country have of Alomar in our minds is a guy running around second base, diving around, or hitting a home run against the Oakland Athletics, raising his hands in the air for that iconic photo. But the Alomar I saw in Puerto Rico was someone who's totally invested just in the smallest details of, you know, growing baseball among Puerto Rican youth. There's a couple specific scenes I wrote about in the piece that really struck me. One was Robbie Alomar just sitting during a game with a bucket of baseballs next to him and just rubbing each baseball down with mud to get rid of the slickness. Now, it's a small thing to see, but it really says a lot about Alomar, because in North America, that's something that is entrusted to clubbies. And here is a Hall of Famer doing that. And then during Scout Day, and, you know, Scout Day for a baseball showcase is similar to any other combine that you'd see. It's just player after player going through repetitious drills, right? And there was 150 players who had to go through their individual drills in this, and Alomar was out there the whole day in the sun. I don't know if you guys have ever been to Puerto Rico, but the sun there in the summertime is very, very intense, especially when you consider the humidity. And Alomar was just, while other coaches were retreating to the shade of the dugout, Alomar was out there the whole day with a smile on his face, and he was involved in and watching keenly as each kid completed their what they had to do. And I was speaking to one of his associates, and he was even telling me that, you know, David, look up to the press box up there. You see those clubhouses up there and boxes up there where Alomar, if he wanted to, could just go rest there. And like you said, enjoy a nice meal, have a drink. And he didn't. He was out there in the trenches, getting his hands dirty, so to speak, with the rest of the kids.
David, can you paint the picture for our listeners when you arrived in Puerto Rico? You're going down there on a business trip. You're going down to see Alomar help out with a scouting program to identify young prospects, but you're going into an island that was literally in many respects torn apart less than a year previous by Hurricane Maria. What was it like, and was there still evidence of that natural disaster, the worst to ever hit that country?
Oh, definitely. When you're going on the plane and you're entering the island, you can see as you look down lots of little blue rectangles. And as I wrote about in the piece, you know, at first you think that looks artistic. It looks beautiful, right? It almost like the Greek island of Santorini with the blue roofs. But when you get closer, you kind of see that those are tarps. They're not roofs by any means. Those are tarps that were meant to be there for a very short period, but because the recovery effort is still continuing in Puerto Rico, those tarps still exist, and they haven't been replaced by actual roofs. Now, to be fair, I only was in San Juan for the duration of my trip, and San Juan, for the most part, it's the capital, so it is back to business. But a telling thing for me was late at night one night. You know, you hop in an Uber, and the Uber drivers were telling me stories about how business for them took a major hit because connectivity on the whole island was lost for 3 months. And then besides that, even something small like a McDonald's, for example, I mean, Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory. And in the U.S., McDonald's is a big deal, right? Just like it is in Canada. And most McDonald's are open 24 hours or if not open pretty late. The McDonald's in San Juan had to close at 9 p.m. because of the power shortages that still go on there. Not everybody has full capacity of power. So, you know, something as small as a McDonald's closing early, I mean, it's kind of small, but it does speak to the fact that this island is not yet in recovery, in full recovery mode. And also, I spoke to the mayor of San Juan, and she was saying that, you know, don't let anything fool you. If another hurricane were to touch down in Puerto Rico, they're not ready. And this is hurricane season as well. So by no means don't believe anyone who tells you that the island is completely back to normal, because it's not.
No, and I mean, we wish them all the best there, but you made some great points. They're asking, for example, in that one piece in the article where, you know, you can send a guy to the moon, but you can't give us water 1,000 miles off the U.S. coastline. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But since we are talking about Puerto Rico and the fact that they are now technically, of course, with the United States, you mentioned and clarify in this article that Puerto Rican high schoolers subject to the same rules as those on the U.S. mainland. Of course, that puts them at such a major disadvantage compared to some of their Caribbean neighboring countries there. Is this something that the PR-12 program is really going to help change for the future? Because Roberto Alomar, he was adamant that this is not just a one-and-done deal. He wants to make this an annual event in Puerto Rico and really shine the light on the talented youngsters there. Starts with 150, the ones that you were part of this past summer. But how can they get themselves on equal footing with some of their counterparts in America?
Yeah, so they're always going to have that challenge where they're competing against kids from the United States, the mainland U.S., who high schools in the States, as Carlos Baerga says in the piece, high schools in the States are just much different. They're more advanced. They almost look like colleges or universities. The high school baseball programs are really advanced compared to what they are in Puerto Rico. So one of the things is, you know, Puerto Ricans have had to adapt to the draft coming to Puerto Rico. It came in 1989, and we did see a giant dip about 10 years ago. Puerto Rican numbers of MLB players reached its lowest point, but it's kind of climbed back up now. People are adapting and understanding what needs to be done to get more Puerto Ricans in baseball, in MLB. But one of the things Alomar was adamant about is this is not just a baseball thing. This is an education thing as well. So if a prospect shows well at this tournament and goes to a college, that can change his life. If he gets a college scholarship and attends college in the U.S. mainland, that could change his life. If baseball doesn't work out, he can come back to Puerto Rico a better person. He can be, you know, a doctor, a lawyer, anything, but someone who can bring something stable back to the country in terms of an education and then help others grow. So Alomar is not only looking at this from a baseball perspective, but also an educational perspective as well.
It's just so fascinating because, like I said earlier, no one would blame Roberto Alomar if he wanted to enjoy retirement the way a lot of Hall of Famers do, which is with a lavish lifestyle and enjoying what they've earned every penny along the way. But this is so groundbreaking. And again, if you haven't read the article and the report yet from David Singh, it's on sportsnet.ca, Roberto Alomar, his Puerto Rico PR-12 tournament. It's a fascinating read. David, before we let you go, there was something that transpired last night in the MLB that has a lot of people talking and buzzing this morning. Of course, between the Braves and the Marlins. Now, Acuña on that incredible streak at 20 years of age, those leadoff homers. I mean, this is the fascinating storyline to follow, especially because not a lot of young batters in today's game, unless you're, you know, Aaron Judge, have that kind of attention. And yet, Ureña, the first thing he does is intentionally throw the ball right to his elbow. Obviously, no place in the game. Personally, I'd like to see Ureña suspended for the rest of the season for such a gutless act like that. Where do you come off on what we all witnessed last night between the Braves and the Marlins?
Yeah, what the incident tells the world is that pitchers are so scared of this 20-year-old rookie that they don't even want to throw to him. They don't want to challenge him. They don't want to give him anything to hit. And it was a little bit of a cowardly move by Urania. You know, first pitch of the game, right in the elbow, it looked ugly. And the kicker for me was that it's the hardest pitch Urania threw all year. So, you know, it was obvious that it was intentional. And, you know, I certainly hope, and I think a lot of people will agree, that MLB does something. You know, this speaks to a larger issue in baseball of retribution. Those kind of beatings were once accepted in the game, you know, back when Bob Gibson played, and then when later on when Roger Clemens patrolled the mound. But not anymore. One thing we need to remember nowadays is guys throw much harder. Back in the day, how many players threw 99 miles per hour compared to the number of players who do now, right? The answer is it's night and day difference. So the hitters are actually defenseless in the batter's box, and they're becoming more and more defenseless. You saw Acuna last night. It was clear he tried to turn his body and let it hit his back, but his elbow just kind of got caught in an awkward place, mm-hmm. and that's where it hit him, in the elbow, and now he's out for a couple of days. But he was clearly trying to turn and let it hit his back. So even that's a perfect example of someone who doesn't have enough. There's no time to react when a 97-mile-per-hour pitch is coming at you. So hitters are defenseless, and you hope that MLB does make an example out of this situation, because this seemed to generate a lot more headlines than typical retribution or beating pitches would. So I definitely hope MLB takes notice and acts on this.
A few more moments here with David Singh from Sportsnet.ca, talking all things Major League Baseball. Toronto Blue Jays winding down their year. They're getting set to carry on their series with the Kansas City Royals. First pitch will be just after 5 o'clock Vancouver time. Curtis Granderson doing himself and I think his club some favors as the season winds down. Where do you think his trade value might be now, considering he's been playing some pretty good ball?
Yeah, last night he really did do himself a favor with a home run off of a right-handed pitcher. And that's what's going to attract teams that could potentially deal for him before the end of the month. He is a serviceable outfield platoon guy, you know, hit against right-handers. He's good in the clubhouse, can play decent defense in the outfield. He just cleared waivers, and there was talk in July that the Jays had a deal to trade him. It's not, you know, and nobody knows what team, but Cleveland certainly seemed like a logical fit, and they were rumored, they were linked to him at some point. Now, Cleveland went out before July 31st, and they got Leonis Martin, who now is out with a life-threatening bacterial infection, and they don't know when he'll play. Obviously, he needs to focus on himself and, you know, get himself back to health, but that does leave the Indians in a position where they're back to square one. So I think Granderson could be a good fit for Cleveland. Another team to watch, I think, is the New York Yankees. Mm. They got word that Aaron Judge is going to be out longer than expected with his wrist injury, and their outfield depth has taken a hit. Clint Frazier, who is one of their top young outfield prospects, has been dealing with post-concussion symptoms, and I think he's got a little bit of dizziness right now. So that's a depth hit. Jacoby Ellsbury is out for the season. So the Yankees could use an outfielder, and Granderson definitely could be an option because he's played in New York. He's played for the Yankees and the Mets. And also, keep in mind, the Yankees and the Blue Jays are very familiar, having gone down a long, long trade discussion route surrounding J.A. Happ.
Right.
So both teams are very familiar with each other, and the Jays definitely know the Yankees farm system well. I mean, you're not going to get a great return for Granderson, but the Jays have done their homework on the Yankees minor leaguers, so that is just something to keep in mind concerning the Yankees in this trade fit.
Absolutely. And I think it was curious to a lot of people at the non-waiver trade deadline a month ago when Curtis Granderson was still a member of the Toronto Blue Jays. So I think we're all in agreement that his days as a Blue Jay probably very much numbered. Hey, David, want to thank you for giving us some time here this morning, and just really enjoyed your piece on Roberto Alomar. And again, if you're listening and you haven't read it yet, sportsnet.ca is the place where you can check it out. Thanks so much for your time, Dave.
Really appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
You got it. David Singh from sportsnet.ca there again.
Sportsnet 650.